This is me telling you this. The program is Media Network.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another program from the Media Network Vintage Radio Archive.
Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service.
Now, for the next part of the program, please return your seat to the upright position and fasten your safety belt.
Media Network presents the South Pacific Safari. Jonathan Marks escapes from the dreary winter days in Europe to surface on the other side of the world in Auckland, on the North Island of New Zealand. We join him in the arrival hall.
The scraggy blonde woman on the other side of luggage belt number 4 in Auckland Airport isn't really looking at me. She's staring through me, and my red eyes are staring back through her. We're all still a bit mesmerised by an extensive flight from somewhere. For unless you've just sneaked across from Eastern Australia, or perhaps one of the Pacific Islands, New Zealand is a long trip for just about anyone else. So this flock of what must be about 400 dehydrated sheep is milling around with trolleys, each praying that their suitcase will be the first one out of the plane. Then they can escape and relax. Then a sun-wrinkled lady comes over and announces that she's offering a free cup of tea while you wait. But no one takes her up on the offer, and she waddles off. And then you gradually become aware that some of the airport terminal walls are painted with scenes of evergreen forests and waterfalls, and someone has piped in recordings of native birdsong. New Zealand is nature smack bang in your face, right from the moment when a million shades of green stare up from the fields below, as the aircraft circles, hesitates, and then decides to go for the landing. But the long journey is matched by a huge welcome. New Zealanders are proud and pleased you've made the effort and keen to explain that there's a lot going on, like elections, for instance. On the 27th, the polls open. Hopeful candidates stare out from the billboards, making a canal of one-liners as we take the highway from the airport to downtown Auckland. The faces are a mixture of Europeans, Indians and Pacific Islanders. Brian Clark, Media Network's correspondent in New Zealand, has come to pick me up. Brian's high up in the airline business, so he knows the ups and downs of travelling. And spying a traffic jam ahead, we opt to escape via an exit that's a shortcut, I'm told, through one of the suburbs. Suddenly it's like driving through a country lane in Scotland, a Scotland that has long since vanished, except that the tree varieties are all wrong and unfamiliar and subtropical. Brian explains that the green hills are in fact extinct volcanoes. Further south, there are active hot springs and geysers. Indeed, the hotel foyer is full of spectacular postcards, and brochures scream adventure holidays with ropes, canoes and exercise. The hotel room on the 7th floor has an occluded view of Auckland Harbour. Behind me is a gigantic hypodermic syringe, better known as the Sky Tower, which seems to be trying to suck out a sample of lava from the worn-out volcano on which it's built. The well-to-do enjoy the panorama from the revolving restaurant on the top, bathed in high-power FM and television signals from the antenna sticks on the pinnacle just above. Darkness falls around 6. Floodlights start dancing on the racing boats competing in the America's Cup. .com. That's about 500 metres away. And .com because you can order all the merchandise over the internet and even play a virtual reality version of the yacht race, even if you live on the other side of the planet. The hotel is bursting with muttering people in caps and anoraks and slick logos and a passionate interest in boats. Brian Clark and I share a passionate interest in radio. He points out that broadcasting in New Zealand has a nautical connection. In Northern Europe, stations like Radio Caroline and Veronica anchored offshore in the North Sea back in the 60s. They were trying to break the state monopoly on broadcasting in the UK and the Netherlands. In New Zealand, a similar pirate ship saga revolves around Radio Hauraki.
Yes, through the 40s, 50s and 60s, radio was very proper. The BBC News was the only news heard until the late 50s, I believe. But in 1966, we had several groups of people decided that the broadcasting format of the day, very staid, none of the new pop music coming out of Europe being played. Back in those days, even I myself would tune into Australian stations like 2UE and get the latest in pop music. So two groups of people were looking at pirate radio. They eventually came together. That was where Radio Hauraki was formed. They eventually put to sea. They were breaking the law of the time. The government of the day was deliberately interfering from Wellington, the capital city, directing the marine department to obstruct the ship taking to sea.
And then one evening they tried to escape.
Yes, the boat was in what's called the Viaduct Basin in Auckland Harbour, where fishing boats were moored. The basin itself was separated from the sea by a type of drawbridge, and this was generally open on a Sunday, so the Radio Hauraki men decided that would be when they would set to sea. However, the authorities, the police and that were there watching, and as soon as there was evidence that the ship was about to leave, they began to lower the drawbridge. There were a huge number of local supporters at the time. The public were really behind this.
You see signs in the crowd on the television documentary that we've been watching saying they were the good guys.
Yes, that was the slogan they adopted. And they were seen as the people who were thumbing their nose at bureaucracy and trying to inject some life into broadcasting.
We are the good guys, the young New Zealanders. On Radio Hauraki. 1480. Top of the dial.
So as the ship was attempting to leave the viaduct basin, they began to lower the drawbridge. Members of the public were underneath the drawbridge in the mechanisms and at risk of being killed, squashed by the machinery. The ship itself got stuck against the drawbridge, the mast against the bridge. Members of the public then helped to free it by pulling the ship over onto its side. It sailed clear, but the police launch was waiting on the other side. The crew were arrested, put in prison. The subsequent court case was thrown out when they were able to prove that there had been political interference, so they were freed. They then put to sea very quietly with no one around and set up in the Hauraki Gulf out from Auckland. There was a small area in the Hauraki Gulf that was outside the 3-mile limit of the time. It was a great hit. I was listening in Wellington myself, about 300 miles to the south, and the excitement of those days, even as far away as Wellington, was very apparent.
Yep, life is really worth living when you're born free. And Mr. Matt Munro is open our first show on Radio Hauraki on this beautiful day in Auckland City.
As I recall, it was a kilowatt. I've got my QSL card somewhere to confirm that, but I guess being from a seaborne location, the sky wave did seem to go a lot further than would normally be the case.
This is it, sound of modern radio, home of the Jack.
Well, as I recall, it was probably about 1970 eventually when the law was changed to allow private broadcasting. Radio Hauraki got the second licence, they didn't get the first licence. But they got the second licence in Auckland, and once they were on the air and competing for the commercial dollar, the New Zealand Broadcasting Corporation commercial stations at the time, mainly the ZB network, began, I guess, to change their format to respond to listener demand.
Listening to those jingles there, they say 1480. Presumably that goes back to the days when New Zealand radio stations were 10 kilohertz apart on the medium wave dial.
Yes, Jonathan, in 1978 New Zealand converted to the European standard of 9 kilohertz separation, and the frequency then became 1476. Subsequently, Radio Hauraki got an FM licence and eventually discontinued AM broadcasting. FM started in earnest in New Zealand in the early 80s, quite late by comparison with many other countries.
Now let's move to the current broadcasting scene. Maybe tonight if we grab the radio and just do a little bit of a band sketch.
Today's high, 21 degrees. Congratulations again, Paul Stevens, who picked up 10 autographed guitars about another half hour ago at Hauraki with the Morning Pirates.
And there they are now, 99 megahertz exactly. What's happened to the old frequency of 1476, though? That seems to be in use again.
Yes, we're fortunate here in Auckland, Jonathan, to have the BBC World Service relayed 24 hours a day on that frequency. Today, the frequency is actually operated by what is called the Auckland Radio Trust. And this is a group of people, BBC fans, who have got together to sustain that broadcast into Auckland.
My name is Roger Hall, and as well as being an author and playwright, I'm one of the 10 trustees of the Auckland Radio Trust, bringing the BBC World Service to Auckland. The Auckland Radio Trust supporters card allows you to contribute $50 towards our costs.
The BBC World Service is brought to you by the Auckland Radio Trust. Now we return to the studios in London.
Well, the curious thing about it is that you're getting the North American feed, and it's also slightly delayed, sometimes by as much as nearly 2 minutes.
Yes, using computer technology, at the time pips for the hour, a two-minute insert is made into the program, station identification, but then promotional and commercial advertising for both the prime sponsors and also spot advertising from other sponsors. Then at 2 minutes past the hour, the programming from the hour itself commences, and in the next 58 minutes, that 60 minutes of programming is compressed, I guess by slightly speeding up the audio, it's certainly not obvious, so that when the next time pips occur, then we have the commercial and promotional break.
The next day, Brian arranged a well-attended meeting at the New Zealand Radio DX League, in which I had a rare chance to meet Media Network listeners face-to-face. And it was great to share their experiences, I can tell you. And they helped me compile this audio impression of what's on local radio.
Be sun smart and join the thousands of other Kiwis by wearing a hat. Hat Day, brought to you by the Cancer Society and Classic Hits.
It's out the 70s, 80s, 90s and today. Classic Hits, 97 FM.
From New Zealand's top news team, Radio Pacific News.
From IRN at 8 o'clock, I'm David Burke.
Southern Star Network News.
Good morning, I'm Andrew.
Radio Rima, good morning to you. Let's have a look in the New Testament of the Bible. Jesus' last instructions to his disciples.
I-98.
In here, life is beautiful. Cabaret, brought to you by Ridges Hotel and ATC, in association with Newstalk ZB.
Big boxing tonight, downtown convention centre, 7:30.
Bullshit Free Radio on Auckland's 90.2 FM. This is The Rock.
Brian arranged a tour of the Radio Network House, home to many of the commercial stations like Radio Hauraki, and what's left of public broadcasting in New Zealand. The National Party, which swept to power in October 1990, has created one of the world's least regulated and protected economies. In the coming days, the electorate will decide whether they've gone too far or whether more government corporations will be privatised. Our guide round Radio Network House was Barry Hartley, Operations Supervisor for Radio New Zealand in Auckland. Public and private broadcasters are now boxed in side by side.
We are now totally separate. We're actually a tenant of theirs, and we've been compressed into a very small corner of the building, I'm sorry to say, so it's not what it used to be.
What I notice, indeed, that every, you know, you go around one particular corner, you see another radio station.
Yes, in the commercial area, they're all little shoeboxes, aren't they?
But how many stations are there in the Auckland region?
There are about 26. It's quite a congested radio market, actually. Most of them are actually FM stations, and there are quite a few AM stations for niche markets. Like, there are Chinese stations, there's a Pacific Islands radio station, and a Maori station.
Is medium wave dying?
I think it is slowly, but it still has a big presence. For instance, our domestic service, National Radio, for Radio New Zealand, is still exclusively on medium wave, AM, although we hope in the next few months to get our first FM transmitter up and running in Auckland. A frequency has been found, but we have to find the money to buy a transmitter.
Because what I notice listening to the FM stations here is that the whole FM band isn't used.
No, above about 100 megahertz is still unreleased. It's been carrying things like taxis and utility services until now, but it's going to be released in the next few months.
So that's a huge fight, no doubt, for those frequencies.
Oh, yeah, and it's going to be a huge money spinner for the government too, who's going to sell off the rights to those frequencies.
So what's the situation now with the current situation with broadcasting Radio New Zealand? Is it government finance? How is it financed?
It's currently financed by a TV licence fee, of all things, but that's being phased out in July next year, and from then on it'll be a grant from the government from general taxation.
Of course, it's very political at the moment because there's an election campaign running.
There is.
And when are the elections?
On the 27th of November. Oh. Every time the government changes in New Zealand, they have a go at broadcasting in some way. They change something.
Well, indeed, what has really fascinated me walking around this building is seeing all these different radio stations operating in very, very tiny spaces. They all sound much bigger than they are.
I do. Well, you compress your transmitter, you shout, you scream, and you make it sound exciting.
But you still love the radio medium.
Oh, I wouldn't work anywhere else. I just love it. Television in this country is really appalling. It's 100% commercial these days. It's just, you know, just atrocious.
Hits of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and today.
And today.
Auckland's Classic Hits, 97 FM.
At the present time, the New Zealand FM stations stop at 100 megahertz. There are some small stations between 100 and 100.8. Micro-broadcasters, tourist information radio in Japanese and German, frequencies in that area. A number of micro-broadcasters, which don't need to be licensed, with a range of a few kilometres. So it can be quite interesting. What has been holding up the auctioning of the frequencies has been appeals by the Maori population of New Zealand that the broadcast frequency ranges are in fact a natural asset and that they, as the indigenous population, should in fact receive some recompense when that natural resource is auctioned off to the general public by the government.
So they expect some money.
Indeed they do. I would expect after the election, whichever party comes into power could really dictate how that particular legal appeal is handled.
As far as ethnic broadcasting then, in other words, broadcasting in the Maori language, but also broadcasts, for example, in Hindi, they do exist, but they're on AM, is that right?
Yes, we've got a number of ethnic operators. 531 is Pacific Islands Radio. Well, the next ethnic station will be 810, which is Access Radio in Auckland. That carries programming in many dozens of languages.
Including Dutch, I notice a number of times a week, because there's a network calling itself Echo Radio that hires that frequency. Let's have a listen to that.
Tune in every Wednesday at 4:25 p.m. to listen to the Punjabi Bhanga music on Punjabi cultural program Gaana Punjab, here on Access Community Radio 810 AM, the Rio People's Radio Station.
Thank you to the Madhura Group. There's more for listeners from southern India in 5 minutes at 8 o'clock. With the South Indian Association.
It's a charitable trust. The airtime is sold off to groups or individuals wishing to make a program. They persevere, they're keen with what they do.
Ah, further up the dial?
Well, 990 would be the next of the foreign language stations. This is Ace Broadcasting. It broadcasts in Chinese. Programming includes BBC Mandarin programming.
Okay, now let's try above 1,000 kilohertz.
Down and taking you towards the new millennium, weekly every Saturday night at the Duke of Wellington, Mount Vernon Hopper, with Club Rangila.
Who's on 1386?
This is Radio Tirana, which broadcasts in Hindi. Auckland has quite a large Indian population, many of them, in fact, from Fiji. During the military coups, there was quite a move of Fijian Indians to New Zealand.
You say Radio Tirana, not Albania?
No, it's spelled T-A-R-A-N-A.
Find me a beast to shame me, that's your brain.
And that's just a sample of hundreds of stations scattered across New Zealand. While a nostalgia station was playing on 1593 kHz, we asked Barry Hartley to recall his experiences of Radio New Zealand International, the country's external service. Barry started his career at their transmitter site.
I did. I actually started back there in 1960. I was a trainee technician in those days, and I actually lived half a mile away down the road, so it was a logical place to work as a trainee technician.
Where was the old transmitter site?
It was at Titahi Bay, which is about 20 miles northwest of Wellington on the coast, facing towards Australia.
And why was it there?
Because it was remote. In the days the transmitting station was established as a medium wave station back in the late 30s, it was away from population. Times have since changed, I have to say, but it was a good place to be.
And the transmitters also had a wartime connection?
They did. The old shortwave transmitters were made by AWA in Australia. They were made for the American forces, who left them behind when they went, and the New Zealand government took them over. And in 1948, they used them for a service to the Pacific and to Australia, which was pretty ambitious, really, with 2 7.5-kilowatt transmitters, but they seemed to work most of the time.
Well, for many years, I mean, of course, it was for especially people in Europe, a huge DX challenge to try and pick them up.
It actually was for me in Australia when I lived there in the 60s, too. It was often very hard to hear, but it was good to hear news from home.
Now, that's, of course, been replaced by a 100-kilowatt transmitter. What's happened to the old transmitter site?
They're still sitting there. The transmitters are still sitting there to this very day because it costs a lot of money to move them. The medium-wave transmitters are still there. They've now got modern solid-state transmitters, and it's now unmanned.
So a ghost from the past.
It is. I've been back there, and it's rather strange. You walk in the door, and there's no one there. But some of the old transmitters still sit there, and you wonder if it was all a dream.
This is Radio New Zealand International, broadcasting from Wellington.
Later in Sainsbury, frequency manager at Radio New Zealand International came up from Wellington to see the Media Network Roadshow. With days before the election, the Labour Party says if it wins, it will invest in broadcasting to neighbours in the Pacific. The National Party, on the other hand, gives New Zealand's external service a much lower priority. So how does Adrian view the future, bearing in mind they've already been through one round of cutbacks?
Well, I think we're still fairly rocky. We suffered a financial cut a couple of years ago, you're quite right, and we lost staff. We went from 11 down to 9. A lot of our ethnic broadcasting went with it, unfortunately. We were doing special programs in Tongan and various other Pacific languages. That all disappeared except for short bulletins in the morning during the breakfast session. We managed to save that. Basically, our shortwave service now comprises in the mornings breakfast time from 5 a.m. until 10 a.m. in the morning, covering sunrise across the Pacific. We broadcast to the Pacific Islands with world and Pacific news and also 5-minute bulletins in different languages, and that's about the end of it.
Well, more from Adrian in a future show. But to conclude today's safari, Brian Clark and I did some direction finding to track down a station with perhaps the smallest power in the world.
Number one, legit. Don't believe in other people, thieving in the ideas that our cerebrums cultivate and create.
What are you gonna do for the people?
100.6 and 88.2. George.
This show, of course, is brought to you by Soho Kitchen and Bar down the bottom of Hobson Street, where you'll find fabulous happy hour from 5 to 7 p.m. during the week. They make a very good non-alcoholic margarita down there. Anyway, this is the Girl Sunday Show, and you are listening to George.
Driving into the inner part of Auckland, George FM suddenly faded in. A local cafe owner directed us to a narrow door backing onto a car park, and we climbed the stairs to solve the mystery of the strange name. All right, can you give me your name?
Oh, I'm Daryl Turner.
Why is it called George FM?
The main reason we called it George is we were going to start a dance or a new jazz station. We didn't really want to call it Jazz FM because it would have bound us to jazz, and we didn't want to call it Dance FM because that would have bound us to dance, and dance can mean so many different things to so many different people. So we gave it a completely non-committal off-the-wall name, and George was the first one we came up with. It could have been Mildred or something like that, and we were even thinking at one stage of calling it Cucumber FM, you know, cool station, cool as a cucumber.
And you're a micro-broadcaster. What does that mean in terms of your transmitter power?
It means that we broadcast on a very low power of 1/3 of a watt. The basic secret to getting something out of that is you have a certain amount of processing to get the maximum amount of that, an efficient aerial, and of course your placement. We're at a good height above sea level and above surrounding terrain, so we manage to reach a good number of people.
And how far can you reach then from here?
We serve an area that's known as Inner Auckland. We can get quite a distance. It depends on atmospheric conditions and things like that. We can get heard as far out as Te Aritu and Henderson, and even over in Greenhithe, which are about sort of 10 k's away from here.
Oh, with a third of what? That's amazing. I see you've got actually a very sophisticated automation system, something I recognise because we use it at Radio Netherlands. And how many people work for the station?
About 40 DJs and about 10 support staff, you know, doing office work, out selling advertising, making themselves visible.
But the disc jockeys don't get paid?
No, we all do it for love. And the thing about the dance scene in general is that a lot of people are in it for love. A lot of the stuff that gets played here is on vinyl, and it's made by people who have the George philosophy. They live in fish and chip shops above Hull and work long hours of the night in the middle of winter producing this stuff for love, and we end up with it here.
Can I ask you why you're a disc jockey at this radio station?
Oh, I sort of got into it by accident, really. I've got 2.5 children. No, some friends of mine who sponsored one of the shows here asked me to present the show, and I had no previous experience in radio at all. And I said, yeah, OK, I'll do it. And I've learnt such a lot here. It's been magnificent. I've met some talented people, and the music is the barometer of your mood, if you like. And I think every show is different, and every day has its own flavour and its own mood because people bring their own experiences. And, yeah, it's good. It's really varied.
And then you go out to where it's all happening.
It's research, really, you know. You've got to know what's going out in the real world before you can come and try and represent it on a dance station. That's what I claim, anyway.
Why are stations like this needed compared to them? I mean, they've got bags of commercial stations here in Auckland.
That's exactly why, because when I go outside of the 10K zone that George broadcasts in, and you try and find something to listen to, and you just get endless liners and everything's, you know, it's all totally rehearsed. Today's heard music. Welcome into a 15-minute music marathon. It doesn't mean anything, and it's just people. It's become complete formulaic radio, and I think that's the thing. People want to hear real people playing good music they haven't necessarily heard, and they might not hear it again, but it's just a good show.
So we've managed to survive now for about 1.5, nearly 2 years, I guess.
But mind you, because I presume a lot of the energy doesn't go into the transmission costs.
Oh, no, if the worst comes to the worst, we can stick a couple of mice on a treadmill and set them to work in the cupboard there, you know, a bit of cheap cheese from down the road, and away they go, George stays on air. We've got no problems with Y2K because of that.
The day we got a microphone was great, I remember that day.
Oh,
just took us miles ahead, that one.
Oh, and then every time we get a new stylus on the turntables, it's really exciting.
There was a time where you could actually like double George's listenership by opening the windows and turning the speakers outwards, you know. Good windy day, you'd just be like, people would be calling you from like two houses down, you know.
That sounds great.
Those guys also run a website at www.georgefm.co.nz, which also radiates the fun they're putting back on the crowded, crazy radio dial in New Zealand. Not a Jaffa station, which stands for Just Another Frequency from Auckland. Well, the crew back in Hilversum will post lots of photos on the Media Network website in December to illustrate this expedition. In the meantime, it's time to head for the airport again. Bye for now.
South Pacific Safari was a special Media Network presentation produced by Jonathan Marks and Diana Janssen. Roadshow management was by Esther van de Plaam. Special thanks to Brian Clark and Radio New Zealand for their help in making this broadcast possible. Next week, the show is in Sydney and the safari continues.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.